When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Ben Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 9, The Midnight Duel.
Ooh, The Midnight Duel. Of the chapters or sequences from the first book, which probably somehow I have actually read the fewest number of times,
really,
I suspect, out of the whole
series.
Like
when you restart, you're just like, skip to two.
Sometimes I'll skip to two. A lot of times I'll just start with Goblet because that has historically been my favorite. And I'm like, yeah, you know, like let's just get
the gist of it.
We'll get right into the full swing of like Voldemort's return and everything that comes, mm-hmm. you know, in the wake of it.
Yeah.
But this is, the Midnight Duel is one of those scenes that is just completely left out of the films. And
the Midnight Duel is, yeah. But they do go out and like find Fluffy.
They do go out and find Fluffy, yeah.
So this is the chapter where the Harry has flying lessons. He catches the Remember-All. He makes the Quidditch team. And then Draco challenges him to a Midnight Duel, and he accepts. And then they go do that, and Draco doesn't show up, but they find Fluffy.
That's right, yeah. Kind of interesting, the fact that this is almost like the last chapter of the Potions Master, where The chapter title is The Midnight Duel, which is sort of the catalyst for a lot of the events of the chapter. However, there is not actually a Midnight Duel.
Yeah, there isn't one. Yeah. There's the challenge of the Midnight Duel, but it does not come to pass.
It does not. So anyway, let's go ahead and dive right on in. We'll just kind of go through as we always do
and
figure out what happens and what stood out to us as the chapter unfolds.
I know. Well, right away, the first sentence, I love that Harry is just like, what is it, like out of the furnace and into the fire when it comes to like Dudley and Draco.
It really is the case. I mean, yeah, Draco could not, even down to the fact that they're like both like D names.
Oh, feels D like, names and like the favorite only, you know, the spoiled only child of people who dislike Harry.
Right. And it's remarkable that like, literally it's like for Harry, it's like, how could you do something? Never have to deal with Dudley again, ever again. And then it's like, oh man.
Right.
Like now there's this guy,
yeah,
you know, in my new world that I love so much. So that's pretty unfortunate for Harry. One of the other things just on that exact note that I think is particularly interesting is that this chapter in particular, I think really, really, really starts to ramp up this idea or constant looming threat of Harry's expulsion from Hogwarts,
which
as a kid, I remember thinking was like this really weighed on me super heavy. Like
constant.
Yeah. Like, I was always like, goodness gracious, like what they were able to establish in terms of what life is like for Harry at the Dursleys and the fact that he miraculously was able to escape that life and go live a better life. And then the fact that like it feels like that knowledge is sort of constantly being used against you, where it's like expulsion on some level, like, you know, would never be a good thing. And especially as like a student, the idea of getting like suspended from school always seemed like a really ominous thing to have happened.
It's
like the equivalent of getting like a jail sentence, but for like an elementary school kid or something. It was like if you were suspended, it was like, because any kid would rather like, you know, stay home and go to school. Like, I mean, going to school.
Oh, usually. I know. I always thought, I remember there was, I think in my entire like elementary school career, there was like one kid who ever got expelled for anything, and he was out of school for a week. And I remember the whole week just being like, I mean, he didn't have to come to school.
I know, but
like,
it was,
it's weird that the punishment is that.
I feel like I was always so astutely aware of how upset mom and dad would be. And if I was suspended, it was like life at home is going to be way harder.
Oh, I mean, like, that's the truth of the situation. But As the students who still have to go to school, you're like, oh,
if anything, they've got it good over there.
Right.
Like, they misbehaved. Now they don't. Yeah. Anyway. So, but it comes up several times throughout the chapter. So that was like one of my closing thoughts was, I was like, okay, they really start to like scale up this like threat. Oh,
yeah. The books would have you believe that the every student at Hogwarts is basically like inching their way next to the edge of a cliff, and at any moment might be expelled for any reason at all.
Well, this is almost how like the wizarding world works as well, where it's like the fact that like any crime sends you to Azkaban.
Oh, I know.
It's like, it's such a harsh punishment for any crime at all. And so it's like, it is interesting, like in a school that is like known to be filled with calamity, like where the Weasley twins have managed to like successfully make it through this many years of
education. Oh, I know. That's the other thing. It's like, it's not really on the table. The other thing is like, you have to admire Harry, like 11-year-old Harry's humility in the situation, because like if he could like step back for like just a second and think about his own situation, if he knew more about his own situation, like he is under zero threat of being expelled. Like Dumbledore's not letting this kid go at all.
Yeah, 100% no. Yeah. Like if he had any idea how important he was to the not just to the overall equation, but even just to Dumbledore as like an individual, there's no way in the world. There's no way in the world. But either way, it comes up several times in this chapter, and that was something that I thought was kind of remarkable. Because there are a multitude of different ways that they think they can be expelled just in this chapter alone.
Oh, I know. So even at the bottom of the first page here, there's this introduction to the idea that Malfoy is talking about how good he is at Quidditch. And he said, Ron says, anyway, I know Malfoy is always going on about how good he is at Quidditch, but I bet that's all talk. But it's not. Which there's this like sort of running trend where it's like Malfoy seems like this annoying obstacle all the time, but it's like he's not like incapable. Like he is a capable opponent, and he is frequently getting things done.
Yes. Yeah. And I think because it, like a lot of times it comes through the lens of him being such a jerk and such a bully.
Right.
Like a lot of times you think that like this is your classic high schooler that's like being mean because he's otherwise compensating for something. But as we see with Malfoy, as time goes on, it's like coming into this year, like part of his jealousy of Harry is literally going to spawn from the fact that what he expected for himself, like potentially being like a like first year in a century to be selected for a Quidditch team, like all things being equal, like Malfoy probably had decent reason to believe that that could have been him.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, if not for Harry, Draco probably is like the most popular kid that year,
you know, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He's very well liked by the other Slytherins, and he is good at other things, and he's even really good at school. Like, I mean, like Harry and Ron squeak into Slughorn's class in sixth year.
Oh yeah, because like, he doesn't require like an outstanding on the
right.
OWLs.
But like Draco just got in.
He just got in, and he's also actively practicing like, you know, legilimency throughout, you know, the whole year against
Occlumency,
against Snape. You know, which is the thing that like Harry can't grasp to save his life. You know, he's like fixing the Vanishing Cabinet. Like, yeah, people don't give Malfoy, I don't think, enough credit for just being an otherwise like, I mean, he's a pain.
He's an absolute pain and absolute jerk. But I think people like, it's easy to like rope him in with like Crabbe and Goyle is like, he's like annoying and he has resources, but he's not actually very good at the stuff, but like he is good at the stuff.
He is good at the stuff for sure. One of the huge ironies though, that we see inside of this chapter is that like really Draco is kind of his own worst enemy when it comes to this whole Quidditch thing, because if not for his like sort of jerk move and picking on Neville and stealing the Remember All, like then Harry doesn't, he's not able to display his, you know, instinctive abilities on a broomstick.
My note at the end of this chapter was Malfoy keeps accidentally advancing the plot for Harry.
Yes, where, absolutely.
Yeah, he takes the Remember All, Harry gets on the Quidditch team. He challenges him to the Midnight Duel, Harry finds the trap door.
Even the fact that, like, from the very beginning that, like, Draco was one of the first fellow students that he ever met and sort of, like, brought about this, like, negativity attached to the name of Slytherin House. Like, even that, it's like Draco was sort of, like, dictating some of, like, how Harry responds to what he's seeing.
I know. There's like a certain amount of, like, Draco is Voldemort's worst enemy and has no idea.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. No, that would be a hilarious plot line to tug on, is sort of like, if anything, I think Malfoy keeps getting in the way of, like, what, you know, if Harry gets to Hogwarts and has no idea about any of this stuff, you know, like, there's a very real chance he just ends up in Slytherin.
Just ends up in Slytherin,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Although that would even suck for Malfoy, because if he became Slytherin's Seeker, then that would mean Draco doesn't make the team as Seeker, you know.
Well, it would, but it's like, I wonder if Draco would have cared. It's like, I think Draco wants to be the Slytherin Seeker because Harry is the Gryffindor Seeker.
So he wants to be able to go toe-to-toe with him.
Right, so because he wants to prove that he's better than him. But if they were in the same house and Harry was already the Seeker, I imagine Malfoy would still want to be on the team as a different position. Yeah,
that makes sense. And we do know from Ginny that you can play more than one position pretty easily, or at least possibly.
Yeah. You can transferable skills.
Yes, of course. We jumped around a little bit here, but like a couple of things I thought were particularly interesting is a piece of trivia that I just highlighted is that Dean's poster is of West Ham soccer team.
Yep.
One of the things I thought was sort of just mildly interesting, and I'd be curious if like other copies of the book read it as football team, just because this is like a UK-based publication.
Oh, you're right.
But it does use the word soccer.
We do have like the Sorcerer's Stone version of the book, so I do wonder if it says football. The next sentence after that says, Ron couldn't see what was exciting about a game with only one ball where no one was allowed to fly. And I'm like, I'm reading that, and like, there is a chance to me that it reads as if Ron has never heard of soccer.
That is how I would interpret it.
Okay, yeah, right?
Yeah.
No, or is he coming into the argument like, oh, Dean, we're not putting that poster up in here. Like, soccer, are you kidding me? One ball, they don't fly? No.
No, I think he doesn't understand. This to me feels like the inverse of sort of like, you know, like the fish out of water like mechanism, I guess, is that like normally Harry's a fish out of water because he's being just introduced to all things new. He's drinking from a fire hose in the wizarding world. Like, everything is new. But on the flip end of things, like, soccer is one of the most popular sports on planet Earth. And so this is like one of those things where Ron has been isolated by the wizarding world and doesn't know
it, which is bonkers, especially like in Britain, where soccer is so big.
Not to mention, with his dad being Arthur Weasley, almost certainly Quidditch is Arthur's second favorite sport.
Oh, yeah,
compared to...
But it's probably not even soccer for like Arthur. He probably likes like cricket or something, some obscure muggle sport. I say that as an American, knowing full well that cricket is wildly popular in almost everywhere else.
Exactly. It's like so many people right now are like, why did you choose cricket? Like,
what are you doing?
How about American football, where it's played in America?
You have other versions of it in Canada and Australia, but then also American football, so much fun. You guys see the Hokies last night? They stomped Syracuse. It was great.
Yeah, totally stepping out of the context of our show here.
I know. Yep. Sorry about that. We'll get back to this now. Okay. But I thought that was funny because literally yesterday I had a message on Instagram where someone was like complaining that like there was no way the Harry Potter books actually took place in the 90s because at no point in the books did any of the characters say like, wow, can you believe the run the Bulls are having right now? It's like, excellent point. But also Ron's never even heard of soccer. So I doubt they know about American basketball.
I think we're clear. Yeah. They didn't know who Jordan was. No, that's hilarious. But okay, so as we move on past the West Ham team, the other thing that I find to be kind of interesting is the way that Hermione sort of struggles a little bit.
Because you
see the first time where, Quidditch is not something you can necessarily, like you can read about it in books, but like it's not something you can learn how to do from a book. Like it needs to be done through some level of like, you know, intuitive relationship with the broomstick.
Yeah, I mean, Harry is acting completely on instinct when he's on the broom.
100%. I mean, it technically is not the first time he's ever ridden a broom.
It's true.
Because we know that Sirius gave him one for his first birthday that would hover like a foot off of the ground.
Yeah.
But like clearly Harry has some like instinctive abilities when it comes to flying. But it is always interesting to me because the other one that I think this also ends up being true for, where instincts sort of outplay what you can learn out of a textbook, is that Harry does outdo Hermione in Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Yeah, so it does tie in there too.
Yeah, it's the one subject that he's able to sort of like edge her out on. It's just kind of interesting that this is like also true for this particular other activity that Harry also happens to excel at.
Yes, it does. So it's like no coincidence though. I love when the mail gets there. When Neville gets the Remember All in this one, there's a few things that I like about this little section here. Is one that it says Harry hadn't had a single letter since Hagrid's note, something that Malfoy had been quick to notice, which is just like, dude, Draco, how obsessed are you with Harry?
Oh my
god!
Like
every morning you're like, did Potter get something? Potter. Read the mail? Read the mail?
He didn't get any mail, right?
I'm watching.
Yeah. So I got to make sure that I'm getting more mail than him. Honestly, it reminds me a lot of in Deathly Hallows, Harry ends up having this like weird obsession with Stan Shunpike being like the one who's like being, you know, manipulated into being a Death Eater. And like it just keeps coming back to Stan. And I'm like, Harry, I don't think Stan was like a great dude who's like being like seduced to the dark side. I mean, he's under the Imperius curse. Like he's not actually a Death Eater.
Yeah.
But it's also like, is Stan the hill that we're dying on over
apparently
here?
Apparently he is the hill that they're dying on. I also love that Malfoy gets packages of sweets from home every almost on the daily, it sounds like, because I'm just trying to imagine either Narcissa or Lucius like packing him a basket of treats, you know, and I'm like, it's like in my mind, like you'd love to think that in most cases, this is just like a mom being like, oh, you know, he's probably homesick. I'm sending him some treats to make him feel good. But like in my mind, Narcissa is packing this basket solely with the intent that like when this lands, the other students will know Draco's better than them.
I think that's exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, her name is Narcissa.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I mean, it's not that far off from Narcissist. So I think 100% she's just literally trying to ensure that everybody knows that like her son is getting like even more treatment than the rest of them.
Yeah.
Almost to a fault, because I mean, on some level you could probably just send enough treats for a week and not send an owl daily.
Oh, I know. It's absolutely crazy. Then just a few lines down, there's when Neville gets the Remember All, like there's Neville was trying to remember what he'd forgotten. I love that. It seems like the obvious problem with the Remember All, like how is it ever going to help you do anything? But in the movies, there's like a very like just neat like eagle eye thing you can notice where if you look at Neville's surroundings as he picks up the Remember All, it turns red. And it's like the thing he has forgotten is his robes. Like all the other students are wearing robes, but he is not.
Oh, I've like, never caught that before.
Yeah, so
that's
that is
so
the thing
clever.
He's forgotten in the movie, which I always think is really fun.
Nope, that's perfect. That's perfect. Okay.
But then it also says when Malfoy comes over to like take it from Neville, it's like it says, who was passing by the Gryffindor table? And it's like, again, Malfoy, stop being so obsessed, because they have laid out for you how the tables are arranged, and there is just no reason at all for Draco to be meandering over towards the Gryffindor table. At all.
He's gone drastically out of his way. And it's probably because he's not paying attention to his own owl's arrival, and he's literally just watching what's happening amongst the other first year Gryffindor boys, and he's gone far out of his way to go and be a menace. Which like that's like one of those things where it says like McGonagall, who could spot trouble quicker than any teacher in the school, was there in a flash. It's like, no, I bet what McGonagall saw was Draco walking across the entire Great Hall.
I know. There's just no reason for him to be there.
It's like guaranteed this is just to cause trouble. So anyway, as we scoot forward though, there is an interesting like little detail that I think helps give us some contextualization. Wow, I don't know why I said context as to how many students are in each class.
Yes.
So we've always known. Did you pick up on this too?
I did. I circled it. Yeah.
Okay. So like one of the big things we've always been really curious about is it seems like there's shockingly few students at school. Basically, we know Harry is one of five boys in the Gryffindor common room. He's of course there with Ron, Neville, Dean, and Seamus. Hermione is...
Not that he's always always aware of that. I'm going to point out for later in the chapter.
Sure, that's a good point. Yeah. But the other is that we know that Hermione knows Lavender Brown and Parvati Patil as the other two first year Gryffindors, and then there are somehow possibly two other unnamed Gryffindor girls that we never get an intro to, which seems shocking.
It kind of does.
Like how could they have no role in anything ever at all?
Or else it's just those three and the Slytherin first years vastly outnumber the Gryffindors.
Which is possible. But yeah, so the line that Jay and I both caught on to here is that the Slytherins were already there. This is for flying lessons. And it says, and so were 20 broomsticks lying in neat lines on the ground. So what we've always sort of extrapolated, and this is based on minimal evidence, but it's essentially that, let's say that there are five boys in the Gryffindor, five girls in Gryffindor, five boys in Slytherin, five girls in Slytherin, 20 broomsticks total.
Yeah.
You know, and then approximately what you end up with is 40 new students per year, 280 students total that attend Hogwarts at once. As we pointed out, though, there is a chance that numbers are overall down during these particular years because these are the students who would have reached age 11 sort of in the wake of Voldemort's peaked power.
Right.
You know, so it's entirely possible that families were not having kids because they were otherwise afraid of what was going on and not wanting to bring children into a world where, you know, somebody like that was at rule, or potentially going to seize rule, you know, or the other is, you know, just simply quite literally fighting in the fight against
Voldemort. Yeah, or they were just being killed.
Right, exactly.
It would almost make sense for there to be more Slytherin kids
in that way, little bit. In that way, it would make sense. Yeah. So
like they would have felt maybe the safest during that time.
Right. So yeah. I don't have an issue assuming that there are 12 Slytherins here and 8 Gryffindors.
Sure. I mean, we know Draco, Crabbe, Goyle, and Blaze are four of the Slytherin boys. And then we know just of Pansy Parkinson, I think, and Millicent Bulstrode of the girls.
I think you're right.
Yeah. I don't, there might be more known ones, but those are the ones that come to mind.
Speaking of Pansy, there was a detail, I don't know if you caught this one or not, that I thought was kind of interesting. But Pansy Parkinson, famously throughout the entire story, will always, always, always refer to Hermione as her last name of Granger. However, on the very next page, Pansy does get like her first speaking lines, I believe, and says, "Ooh, sticking up for Longbottom." A hard-faced Slytherin girl said, "Never thought you'd like fat little crybabies, Parvati." And so she refers to Parvati by her first name. Mm. That's like one of those things where it's like, is there a chance that the Patil twins would have grown up close to or in proximity to Pansy?
I actually wrote that down too. I said, "Did they know each other?"
Yeah, like I mean, because even the Patil twins are sorted into different houses. So,
but they've all got that like alliterative P name as well. They randomly.
Do. Yeah, yeah. And so this is like one of those things where, like, you know, we know that prior to age 11, wizarding kids, you know, are not they're not attending like a formalized school system. They're just educated by their parents. But it's not to say that like a lot of the wizarding families wouldn't just simply know one another and have their kids spending time. So that's like a really, really, really interesting like sleight of hand. I feel like that almost suggests like these girls grew up. Yeah. Knowing each other.
Well, but then
bit.
I think all, that might even continue to track because I think in Order of the Phoenix, the Patil's parents are thinking of taking them out of school.
That is true.
So they might be more like on the ministry side of things.
They very well could be.
Ooh, that is interesting.
That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And that being said, you know, Parvati and Lavender end up being, of course, best friends as Gryffindors, but they can be a little bit at times shallow, it feels. Like, you know, they sort of get like ultra enamored with like divination and, you know, like they're you know, I guess Parvati has a little bit of a crush on Harry as of fourth year and you know, it's, of course, attends the Yule Ball with him. And it's like, is that like, was it because like Harry's like a school champion, you know, and it's like a little bit of social hierarchy.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, and then I think Seamus refers to Parvati and Padma as like the best looking girls in the class or something.
Yes. Yeah. He is.
So,
yeah.
I mean, they're like, she's like a popular girl.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
basically.
Yep. For sure.
Yeah. But I also, this is that said, this was a great chapter for Parvati, which I've never really noticed before. Like when Malfoy starts, he says, did you see his face, the great lump? And the other Slytherins start laughing. And Parvati is the one who speaks up and says, "Shut up, Malfoy." I was like, good for you, Parvati. Look at you don't see Parvati do a lot of standing up to anyone for most of the book. I mean, she's in the DA later
on.
Right,
yes, yeah.
So there is like that. But like this is like a nice tiny little character moment for her. And I think she has another one later on in the chapter as well. We'll see if I can find it again as we keep moving.
Yeah, well, speaking of tiny character roles, let's talk about Madame Hooch for just one hot second, who clearly has just got the most choice position at Hogwarts
School. Oh my gosh.
Of anybody, because near as we know, like, flying lessons are like a really big deal. And I suppose it's possible that like they have other flying lessons that they just don't tell us about. But as far as we know, this is the only one they ever have. And beyond this, the only other thing that we know Madame Hooch to do for the school at all is referee the Quidditch matches,
right,
which, you know, each team plays three games total per season. Like, this is like one of those, like, my brain can never math correctly, but four teams that all play each other, does that end up accumulating?
I think it's six games total.
Okay, yeah. So it's like, it's not a terribly busy schedule.
Yeah, right?
You know,
it's not like, even like she's like running the Quidditch tryouts or overseeing practices or something. Like, maybe she has to like keep track of the schedule when the captains schedule it or something. I don't know.
Possibly, yeah. Like, but it feels like one of these things where like maybe she's just like a resident of Hogsmeade and just sort of like, you know, volunteers at the school because she was maybe like a former, you know, Holyhead Harpy or something like that. You know,
yeah.
like she was a famous Quidditch player once upon a time, is you know, fierce and tough and stuff like that. But like pretty much, you know, just comes in, helps out with Quidditch stuff.
But like, I think even later in this book, she, like, Snape replaces her as the referee for one of the Quidditch matches.
You might be
which
right.
Which is kind of like, oh, I didn't know Snape was so good on a broom.
That it is always kind of
a little surprising.
Yeah. It's like that's like one of those where I feel like there could be like a training montage in like a Marauder series where like Snape, because I mean, Snape is not exactly regarded in any of the flashbacks as being particularly athletic. So it's like, is it possible that like what you would see if you were watching a Marauder series and you know, James and the rest of them going through their years at Hogwarts rather, like if Snape would be like working really hard to actually like overcome what might be like some skill deficiencies in the world of flying and like actually like grows to be good at it somehow.
I mean, I can see him like privately training himself to be good at Quidditch just because of how jealous he is of James.
Yes. Yeah. Almost certainly.
And I mean, he does fly a broom in the Battle of the Seven Potters pretty effectively.
That's true.
So it's like he can do it.
Yeah. I mean, almost certainly at some point in time he becomes proficient. We don't actually know for sure that he ever wasn't, but that's just sort of asserting on the basis of James being your classic kind of like jock, you know, from high school, and Snape being more of like your stereotypical like bookhead or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, so on the note of Madame Hooch a little bit, there's kind of a nice sentimental moment, I guess, if you want to call it that, where she seems pretty tough, you know, like, what are you all waiting for? She barked, you know, and it's like, it's almost immediately like she's kind of got like a little bit of like intensity, but then Neville's broomstick, of course, sort of like goes rocketing off the ground. This is like one of those things in the movie that I actually feel like I would argue was not a detail that was like well executed. Neville is sort of like klutzy on his own, but in the film, when Neville's broom goes up in the air, it's almost bucking him in the same way that Harry's broom is bucking him.
Oh, sure.
First Quidditch match. Yeah. My only like big thing about that is that like we know why Harry's broom was bucking him. Like,
right.
It's specifically because Quirrell is there like actively trying to hurt him while he's on the broom. Like Harry hasn't like lost control, you know, but like when they show it, like Neville doing the same thing, it's like you might just be under the impression like, oh, brooms just do that.
Yeah.
You know, like that might just be like characteristic of.
Whereas, here in the book, he like shoots up in the air and then is like, oh, and just sort of like slumps off.
Kind of almost immediately falls off. But anyway, so that's the thing. Neville falls to the ground. She immediately comes over, assesses the broken wrist. And I think that like, you know, she then like walks away with Madame Hooch, who had her arm around him. So it's like, for someone who was otherwise kind of like fierce, you know, it seems like with Madame Hooch, it's like she clearly cares for like a student in need.
Yeah. I mean, there is that. I also feel like that when I was reading this, I was like, it seems like this, she should have been prepared for almost this exact thing to happen. You know, like you have a bunch of first years who've never been on a broom before. Like certainly you're prepared for one of them to fall
right
from a great distance. Like what shouldn't, you know, this seems like the number one thing you should be looking out for.
It seems like there should be like a spell cast across like the ground or something.
Yeah, you can't go more than 5 feet or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you do fall, it like will cushion your landing.
Or like she, I don't know. Or then even then she just like Neville falls and she's like, all right, I'll leave you all here unattended with the brooms.
Yeah, right.
I wrote, next to that. not a good call, Madam Pooch. Not a great call.
It seems like in every other occasion ever when somebody needs to be sent to the hospital wing, they're almost always sent off either on their own, which I think Neville was literally in the last chapter when he spilled potions on himself, or another student guides them up to the hospital.
Yeah.
So it's like the fact that the teacher's taking him is kind of like, is that really necessary?
But yeah, maybe because she's not a real teacher. She's just a volunteer.
Just a volunteer. There you go.
But then, let's see. No, never mind. Okay. Never mind. We'll come back to it.
Okay.
Let's see.
No,
yeah. Malfoy goes into the air. He throws the Rememberall. Harry realizes he's immediately good at flying and catches it. And then McGonagall sees him and she comes out and she's like, how dare you? Might have broken your neck.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm almost surprised she's like so mad at him when she's there to...
I think she's putting on a front.
Oh, you think she's like...
That's my thinking here, because I think McGonagall has such a soft spot for Quidditch.
Yeah.
Like, this is like one of those things where I think she's normally very stern as like her resting demeanor. But I think in this particular instance, she knows that what the rest of the students need to see is sternness. Like, that's my read on the situation. Like, she's almost like, well, I can't go out there and just be like, well done, Potter.
Yeah.
You know, like that sends a bad message to the rest of the kids. It's like, they need to think that he's being punished for exactly what's about to happen here.
But guess who speaks up?
Who speaks up?
It's Parvati.
Is it Parvati?
Yeah.
There we go. That's your moment.
She says, it wasn't his fault, Professor. And she says, be quiet, Miss Patil. And I'm like, oh, she's the first one to speak up for Harry.
Way to go, Parvati.
I know. Way to go. This is probably your best chapter.
She does she does start strong. There's one thing we just glided over real quick that I just want to touch on
fast. Yeah,
just
yeah.
Simply because it comes up later. But Harry's first moment, coming off the ground on the broom, it says, in a rush of fierce joy, he realized he'd found something he could do without being taught. This was easy. This was wonderful. Mm-hmm. The only reason I bring it up is just this is the memory Harry goes back to when first trying to cast a Patronus.
You're right. Yeah.
So this is that's just like sort of like a notable, like, you know, that means that like in this moment, like this is like one of the best things that's ever happened to Harry before.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, even more so than Hagrid's arrival or going to Gringotts or getting his wand or meeting Ron.
Being on a broom. It's like the amount to which Quidditch is important to Harry is like one of those things that like very much think it's like glossed over in the movies. He's sort of like just on the team in the movies, but like his motivation for like even learning the Patronus, it's not because he's like cares about defeating Dementors or doesn't like them or something. It's like, it's so he can play Quidditch.
Yes.
Like that is his primary motivation. Like when he's dating Cho, like with the only thing he knows to talk about, let's talk about Quidditch.
Yeah. This is my thing basically.
This is it.
It's that and defeating Dark Lords.
That's it. That's what I do.
What would you like to choose? Your boyfriend was killed by one of them. Okay. So Quidditch it is.
So Quidditch it is. And then she's like, no, actually I really want to talk about that first one. Only that.
That date doesn't.
You probably
go well.
Need to talk about it too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably true.
That you is true. Like, no, I've got Hermione. Harry,
come on, Harry,
dude.
Oh man. Anyway, once again, so basically, as Harry is being like carted away from all of his fellow students there for catching the Rememberall, we get the line, he was going to be expelled. He just knew it. So once again, the threat of expulsion is just kind of constantly looming over him. There's sort of a dark moment, if you will, where of course Harry thinks he's certain he's in trouble. Professor McGonagall goes to Professor Flitwick's class and says, could I borrow wood for a moment? Wood, thought Harry, bewildered. Was wood a cane she was going to use on him? I wrote, yikes. It's like, what has happened? Like, we never get any indication that the Dursleys have done anything physically harmful to Harry.
Yeah.
But like, this is like one of those where it's like, did the Dursleys do something physically harmful to Harry?
I mean, Dudley had the smelting stick, you know.
He did have the smelting stick.
Which is apparently given to students for the express purpose of hitting each other when the teachers weren't looking.
I think that's through the lens of Harry.
Yeah.
That has to be the case. Anyway, so that's like one of those things where I read that line and I was like, I've never caught that before, or it has never really stuck with me before, but I was like, man, that's a scary thing to think is about to happen
certainly,
to you.
Certainly is the way Filch seems to treat the students, as if that's like an actual punishment he's allowed to reach for.
Yes. Yeah. But again, that goes back to Filch's whole thing where it's just sort of like, it's like his whole embodiment is like rule breaking or rule following to a fault.
Yeah.
So anyway, the description of wood I always think is fascinating because I've always loved the casting of wood in the films. I pretty much just like
just make a fire beater.
Make a fire beater.
Yeah.
What turned out to be a person, a burly fifth year boy who came out of Flitwick's class looking confused.
Now, this is one. This is, I just wanted to, like, when McGonagall gets wood from the class in the movies, he doesn't get him from Flitwick's. This is just one of those great moments in all the movies where she gets him from Quirrell's class. And this is where Quirrell's holding up the iguana
for
just no reason.
It's like iguanas are not magical. They're like remarkably common creatures.
Yeah.
No, I know that is like one of our favorite scenes to throw to whenever we're talking about Quirrell. It's just like, why is he holding an iguana?
I know. Can you imagine what they were doing on set? It's like, so he'll be teaching class. Hold this. What?
Sure.
The iguana? Yeah. The big one.
The big one. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Fun fact. My first job was working at a store called Petland.
Yeah.
And one of the things I worked in the fish and reptile department, and the storage container for the iguana tank was clear on the front where customers could come by and, like, you know, peer in at the iguanas. But on the back end was just a bunch of locked doors in, like, the back room that like opened up to the other side. And it was the most terrifying thing in the world, because you would go, you put the key in the door and you would turn it to open it. And then, like, iguanas may or may not just jump on you, because, like, you know, they're all of a sudden the door is opening and they're just like, what's going on?
Freedom.
Yeah. So the number of times, actually one iguana did get out for a very long time and we didn't find it forever, and when we did, it was like five times the size
when
it escaped, because it was like eating all of, like, the crickets and stuff that had jumped out.
That's hilarious.
It was pretty ridiculous. Anyway, that's a total,
so there was just like sort of a wild iguana roaming around the store.
If you ever go to a pet store, you can almost be certain that somewhere hiding behind, like, the walls or tanks or pumps or something like that is like a
rogue snake or an iguana.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So just keep that in mind every time you go in there.
Cool.
Yeah. Almost certainly the case. kind of terrifying.
Awesome.
Yeah. How fun is that?
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Griffin tour. It is going to be such a good time. But as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So, like, for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can, like, wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is, like, so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But, like, they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing in. I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different, like, fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like, they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think, honestly, kids would love this, because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Anyway, so we can continue back on with the story. Let's see here. So we definitely get like the first introduction. It does surprise me when you know more about Oliver Wood as a captain of the Quidditch team. It seems surprising to me that he would be open to a scenario where McGonagall is simply telling him, I found you a seeker. This is going to be your player.
Yeah, this is it.
This is it.
This is it.
But that being said,
you don't need to hold tryouts, which is also weird because later on, I think it's Katie Bell who tells Harry's like, no, you don't need to try out. You're on the team. And she's like, no, don't do that. Like,
right.
Everyone still has to try out. Plenty of people, plenty of teams have gone bad because they just keep hiring the old favorite, or, you know,
the old players.
Yeah, the old players. And it's like, meanwhile, and like you'd think that like Oliver Wood would believe that like to the core of his being, like such a Quidditch player.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Like I'm absolutely having tryouts. Everyone's spot is up for grabs every single year. And yet he's just like, nah, basically the six of us are here from last year. So we'll all be on the team. And McGonagall, you found this kid. I haven't seen him fly, but he's on.
You mean he's flown once?
Cool.
One time ever. Okay.
We're going to win.
That's enough. Yeah, I'm certainly, this is going
to
be amazing.
I do love his, yeah, he does just immediately accept the circumstances and says, we'll have to get him a decent broom, Professor, a Nimbus 2000 or a Clean Sweep 7, I'd say, which to me reads as like so presumptuous. Like what, I want to know the inner workings of like, why they're allowed to buy, who is allowed to buy Harry a broom? Like does the school buy it for him? Does the Gryffindor Quidditch team have like a booster club? Or like, do they have some amount of funds and they're like, we're putting basically all that money that we have into buying Harry a broom.
It is kind of shocking because it is one of those things where it's like, not only are they getting him a broom, but they're getting him like the newest and latest like broom that there is.
I know, but like if the school is capable of getting him a broom, then why doesn't the whole team have Nimbus 2000s?
The fact that different Quidditch players have different brooms is kind of one of those things that it's like, it feels like they should have the same broom.
Like, it does feels feel like that.
You know, in NASCAR, for example, it's like one of the things you may or may not know, I don't know, about like the sport of NASCAR is that they are all driving the exact same car with the exact same abilities. And the idea is who can drive the exact same car the best.
Right. That's what stock car means.
That is what stock car means. Yeah. So anyway, so I do feel like that's always been one of those things where it's like clearly as Harry becomes, you know, a captain later, like he never refers to a situation, and maybe it's because Ron has already like gotten a broom, but it never seems like Harry is like, oh yeah, Ron, don't worry, man. Like we'll get you a new Nimbus 2001. Like, you know, we'll
yeah, right. Up. Yeah.
Yeah. Or by that time, probably like a Nimbus 2005 or something. Anyway, but so the next line is, I shall speak to Dumbledore and see if we can't bend the first year rule. This is like one of those favorite fan theories that we've got about the story, but we will soon learn that Harry is the youngest Quidditch player for a school team in almost a century.
In almost a century. But guess who started? So it's 1991.
Yes.
In this school year, as we're reading it. So one century ago would have been 1891. But Dumbledore himself began attending the school in 1892. So yeah. 99 years ago, basically around a century ago.
Yes.
Yeah. And we know that Dumbledore entered his first year, and by the end of his first year was known as the most brilliant student ever and won every like award the school had to offer, which if that's true, it means that he by the time he finishes school or whatever, but it means he also would have had to have won the Quidditch Cup.
At least once
while he was there. And we know that Dumbledore is like really into Quidditch. Like he keeps up with it as well. Like he's he always knows how the Chudley Cannons are doing or whatever.
Yes.
So it seems like Dumbledore's in on it. We see him fly a broom as well when they're coming back from Madame Rose Myrta's to go. True. And it's like, it even says like Dumbledore like leaned down on the broom. Like he knows like he's good at it.
Yeah.
Like
he knows how to handle a broomstick. Yeah.
So.
And the fact that it's literally just like, I shall speak to Professor Dumbledore, see if we can't bend the first year rule. It's like, if anybody was going to allow, you know, somebody to do it, it would probably be going and asking the person who quite literally was the last exception to the rule.
Exactly. So if you ever wondered who was the last first year in a century to make a Quidditch team, it was Dumbledore.
That's our thought, at
That's
least.
Our thought.
Yeah, yeah, yep. There we go. But anyway, yeah, again, I this is like just one of those where I really do love how much McGonagall loves Quidditch herself.
Yes.
On that same note, like it seems like amongst the professors, like, you know, she says, like, I wasn't able to look Severus Snape in the, you know, the face for weeks after their last loss to them. And this is like one of those things where it must be the case that, like, for the professors and heads of houses respectively, it must be like, like, Quidditch is still, like, a point of pride.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely it is. I love, she tells him, your father would have been proud. He was an excellent Quidditch player himself. But I think it's interesting because you later see James, like, walk around the school, and he has a golden snitch with him and catches it. But James was not a seeker.
No, he was not. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. One of the other details that we'll eventually learn is that snitches are specifically crafted, you know, by the maker who makes them, like, while wearing gloves, because one of the things that snitches are capable of doing is providing like a flesh memory to basically showcase like who was the first person to ever handle that particular snitch.
Yeah, in the case of like a, you know, people reaching for it, which to me, even when I think about it, doesn't even seem like it makes sense. Like, it's perfectly possible that like the losing team's seeker like reached out and made a grab for a snitch and just missed.
That's
but
true.
Like touched it.
Yeah, like touched know? It. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know that it perfectly holds up, and it certainly never reads for the first six books of the series at any point in time as if they are not just reusing the same snitch.
Yeah.
But then like when Harry receives it, it's almost as if like Dumbledore like left him a golf ball. You know, it's like,
yeah.
A snitch, what is he doing giving me a, like, you know, I mean, because that would be like, you know, your you know, loved one or whatever passing away and leaving you with a golf ball. And it would be like, you know, this is only cool if the golf ball is significant, you know.
But yeah.
Like, otherwise, like, it's just a golf ball. Mm-hmm. You know, these are like readily common, you know, objects or whatever. So sometimes it does feel like that's like the snitch ruling. It almost feels like it sort of gets developed a little bit as the story progresses.
It does kind of feel that way. Yeah. No doubt as well. I love the bottom of this page where Wood is talking to Harry and he says, only don't tell him, or Harry has been told by Oliver not to tell anyone. He's like, he's talking to Ron and he says, I start training next week, only don't tell anyone. Wood wants to keep it a secret. And literally the next sentence is, Fred and George came into the hallway. Wood just told us. It's like, Wood's already talking about it, man. He told the other team, but like, you know, what I think it's like one person can keep a secret, two can't, you know?
Right. Yep. So that's amazing. We get another reference to Charlie. You know, we haven't once since Charlie left. So this is another one of those situations where I always feel like as the story progresses, Bill like really eclipses Charlie in terms of like Weasley family importance and involvement. Mm-hmm. But Charlie in this first book especially seems to come up on numerous occasions.
Yeah, because he has to get Norbert. They're like, you know, that's going to be his big role later in the book.
That's true. Yeah. So yeah, and there's like a big reason why Charlie will end up being super
but so
relevant.
If they haven't won since Charlie left, how much older is he? Because they like... Ron is in his first year now, and Charlie's been gone for, I wonder, he's the oldest Weasley brother, so more than 7 years.
I don't know. Do we know that Charlie's older than Bill?
Oh, maybe that's not the case.
I don't know.
Bill than Charlie. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I don't know that. Yeah. I don't know that Charlie is the oldest. He may be the second. But the way that I've read it is almost on some level, like especially the fact that McGonagall specifically says like Charlie Weasley himself couldn't have done it. Talking about Harry's dive, it sort of reads to me as if like Oliver would have played with Charlie at some point in time.
Oh, right. Because he would have seen him.
Yeah. Like, so that to me would almost suggest that like if Oliver is a fifth year and Harry's the youngest, it means the earliest Oliver could have started is his second year, which would have been 3 years prior.
Right.
Which means that if Slytherin flattened them last year, then it means that Charlie has at least been out for one season.
Right.
So I would say that it seems like Charlie's maybe like 2 years out of school, but
sure.
Like, that might be like something that's still like you might just need like more information overall. And I've never paid close enough attention to it. I've always sort of assumed that Charlie was like quite a bit older, but I just don't know. Yeah.
Well, no matter what, he's got to be at least by even your own math there, still 8 years older than Ron.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, because they wouldn't have overlapped.
Yeah, they don't overlap at Hogwarts at all.
Yeah,
and at least 1 year on top of that.
But, right. Yeah. Right.
Anyway, moving on. They talk. So Fred and George exit this, and they say Lee Jordan reckons he found the new secret passageway out of the school, but it's that one behind the statue of Gregory the Smarmy that we found in our first week. Which I love this because it's like in their first week. Like, I mean, I love how quickly the twins start, like, searching for secret passageways, because it means that they started finding some without the map.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does mean that. And so it means, like, yeah, like, that these guys were, like, predetermined, absolutely, which also makes me wonder, like, you know, Percy, like, doesn't look for secret passages.
Right.
It does make you, again, wonder, speaking of Charlie and Bill, if either of them had sort of, like, found, like, one or two on their own, so that, like, Fred and George would even know to look for such things.
Yeah, like they're
going
in like, oh yeah, our eyes are open. We're looking for all the secrets.
Right. It's like, you guys found a couple, we'll find all of them. Yeah. It's on. Gregory the Smarmy, I just highlighted and just said trivia. That feels like one of those questions that's like, in their first year, you know, who does Fred and George say that they, you know, where do they find their first secret passage or whatever?
Does Harry ever use that one, the statue of Gregory the Smarmy?
I don't remember. A lot of the secret passages are attached to like specific Hogwarts, like, objects or statues or you know, pieces of the scenery in the castle or whatever, that they do not stick in my brain at all.
Yeah.
These are not details that stay with me.
That's funny. I know that the one to Honeydukes is like in the back of the statue of like the one-eyed witch.
Yes,
right?
The one-eyed witch. I do remember that one. Yeah.
This is like a really cool attention to detail thing. Earlier this year, I was playing through Hogwarts Legacy, which only got like a third of the way through.
Okay.
But like I was just, you know, you're just wandering through the castle, and at some point, like, I looked up on the wall, and like there was just this big painting of the of like trolls in tutus or whatever.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, and I turned around and I was like, this is where the Room of Requirement is, like, it's right here. And then I wasn't at that point in the book or in the game yet, but like, sure enough, later on it was like, boom, this is where it is. And it was like so fun to like realize that like this is from the book. That's right. It's got to be. This is where it is. Where it's supposed to be.
Like the attention and then detail was like right on point. Yeah. That's amazing.
That was amazing. A very fun discovery.
No, but that's so anyway. Cool. Yep, I love it. I love it. Let's see here. So then we finally start to edge forward to the actual midnight duel. You know, the chapter's namesake here, where Malfoy basically comes over and once again is just basically like egging Harry on a little bit, in a way that it's like he's had to cross the whole Great Hall in order to be a pain. Mm-hmm. You start to learn like a little bit, I guess, about what like wizard dueling is, but it still feels
sort
like
sort of.
It feels to me like this is like the 11-year-old's interpretation of how it's supposed to go down, because like basically Ron basically steps in immediately, knowing that Harry basically doesn't know what a wizard's duel is, and you know, Malfoy says like, never heard of a wizard's duel before, I suppose. And Ron's like, no, of course he has, I'm a second, who's yours? And it's like this idea of having like a second in a duel, like this, maybe this is a thing for like real world duels, you know, a la Alexander Hamilton or something. I know.
I'm like trying to figure out what they mean by like a wizard's duel here. Because like, if you're like, what is the situation they're in where it's like it is civil enough for there to be rules, like there is a second to come in, but it's like a situation where death is on the line. And like, it feels like if you're when they're in like the Battle of Hogwarts, people are dueling all over the place, but that feels like wizard dueling in a sense of like, we're fighting in a war.
Yes.
What they're describing sounds more like an organized event.
It absolutely, you know? Does. Yeah.
But it's like, What are the situations where death is on the line, but you're like, but we'll have a backup person, where the backup person isn't just helping you defeat your like deadly opponent?
Well, I think it's like a defending of one's honor type of situation.
Yeah.
Like I think, you know, like in Game of Thrones or whatever, I think Tyrion, this is where he has, oh goodness gracious, if I hadn't started
Jaime.
Is it Jaime who fights on his behalf?
Oh, well, that's, I mean, who he wants to fight on his behalf.
But he ends up having...
Bronn.
Yeah. Bronn fights on his behalf. So, like, Tyrion and Bronn sort of have this particular relationship where it's like, if challenged to a duel, you may have somebody step in your stead and perform on your behalf. And it seems like there's almost, like, associated, like, legally binding or socially agreed upon, like, ramifications based on the win of the duel.
Yeah.
Like, based on who wins. It's like, okay, well, now it's settled. Now we know.
Yeah.
Tyrion wins.
Tyrion wins. But this is, I mean, even this is different. It's not like they each get a champion, you know?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Yeah. It's kind of odd and weird. So anyway, yeah, wizards duels apparently. But what we again realize here is that, like, I think it speaks a little bit to, you know, Malfoy's sort of like slightly more capableness than you might typically grant him. I mean, like, the way he goes about it here is that he very intentionally is able to hook, line, and sinker Ron and Harry in the situation, like, effectively get them to go and be out in the castle in the middle of the night where they're not supposed to be, and at no point in time has intention of actually going and participating in such duel. And on top of that, basically is tipping off Filch as to where they're going to be in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. So I know that's jumping ahead a little bit on the chapter there, but it's sort of like, it's like, I mean, Malfoy is like being pretty, you know, smarmy himself there, didn't we?
Yeah.
Can call it Malfoy the smarmy.
Yeah. I love how when Draco is issuing the duel, he says, "Wizard's duel, wand only, no contact." And then, like, one, like, paragraph later, Harry's like, "What if I wave my wand and nothing happens?" And Ron says, throw it away and punch him. He's like, no, you're already having this apparently civil duel of honor. The one rule was no contact, Ron, okay?
Ron's like, "Ah, screw that.
Punch him right in the face.
He also says, if he tries to curse you, you better dodge it because I can't remember how to block them.
I underlined, "I can't remember," and said, as if you ever knew.
Yeah. Nope, yeah, that's exactly right. I do think there's a couple of interesting things that happen here. One of them is that as they stay up super late in order to sneak out in the middle of the night, they go down into the Gryffindor common room where they are confronted by one Hermione Granger, who basically has stayed up and is like waiting for them to basically try to dissuade them from doing this particular task.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because this is exactly what Neville does later in the book to Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
It absolutely is what Neville does, but I don't know if I would classify like Hermione and Ron and Harry as friends yet.
No, yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. I would agree. Like, I think Hermione's reasoning is very different. But one of the things I do think is really interesting about this is that she then follows him outside of the portrait hole where she then gets stuck because the fat lady had gone on a nighttime visit. And now all of a sudden she's sort of in like a weird situation where she doesn't want to get caught basically sitting outside of the Gryffindor common room, you know, after hours herself.
Yeah.
So she's like, "Well, I'm better off just going with you guys." At that point, they end up trotting into Neville,
yep,
whose arm, of course, had been mended earlier in the day and was unable to learn the new Gryffindor common room password, which is pig snout.
Right.
Which, by the way, they're like the second week of school and they've already changed the password.
Yeah.
Which seems like, guys, maybe that's too often.
It's too often. Like, how are you telling the students this stuff?
I don't know. It just seems like
little meetings.
It seems unnecessarily confusing.
But I also, what it's confusing, this is, let's see, where did I write this down? Oh, Neville says, "Thank goodness you found me. I've been out here for hours. I couldn't remember the new password to get into bed," which, like, how on earth did Harry and Ron not realize Neville wasn't in their dorm? Like, there's only five of them.
That's true.
You know, like, they were up there. Where do they think Neville was?
I think it even specifically says, like, that they were listening to the sounds of Dean and Seamus falling asleep.
Yeah.
You know, but they were staying up late. And it's sort of like, Neville wasn't here, but we weren't concerned about that at all.
No worries at all. Also, I love when Hermione is confronting them. She says, "I can't believe you're going to do this, Harry." Like, end of sentence. Ron, obviously you do this. Harry in particular, so I can't believe
it. Right, right, yeah. No, what I find fascinating about this, so we just made a video this past week on the Super Carlin Brothers YouTube channel where we were talking, what were we talking about? Something to do with Neville.
What if Sirius raised Harry?
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah, yeah. Because basically it ends up being the case that Neville and Harry end up being a little bit closer, and therefore Neville is just like part of the group. And one of the things that we point out inside of that video is that, like, it's like, oh, see the devil's snare when they're going through and doing all the respective challenges. Like, Hermione does potions, Ron does chess, Harry does winged keys. And it's like, we know that Neville's like best subject is herbology. So
right.
It's like, on some level, we made the point. It was like, it almost feels like Neville was intended to be the fourth member of this group.
Right, and like that Dumbledore thought he'd go with them or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like on some level, I was like, this started to be my new headcanon, especially as I was reading this chapter, because I was like, if anything, it does seem like it was like there are four challenges that they go through. We know that.
There's also Fluffy and the troll.
There is also Fluffy and the troll. That's a good point. Yeah. I always forget about the troll because it's already just not.
It's already knocked out. Yeah.
But
Dumbledore is conceivably accounting for that.
Yes.
Because he knows Quirrell is the suspicious one.
Right. Yeah. Right. But the fact that what we end up with in the middle of this night for this first particular duel is this group of four people all being out there, sort of like four unusual circumstances. It feels like Neville was supposed to be a bigger part of this trio. Even the fact that like the Marauders were a group of four and, you know, Harry, Ron and Hermione sort of each respectively represent, you know, like Harry is clearly supposed to be James, Sirius and Ron sort of represent the same role as sort of like diehard best friend, Hermione and Lupin, you know, sort of are like the brains of the operation. And then you've got like, you know, I would never compare Neville to Peter in terms of like you know,
character or anything. Like
Neville outpaces him a million strides.
But they are both sort of that like bumbling boy.
Exactly. That maybe are like, you know, sort of like looking for home or friendship, like with the rest of the kids there or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, it's just like one of those things where it's like, is it the case that like something happened somewhere along the way and it was like too hard to incorporate a group of four into like the storytelling? And so like Neville sort of flits in and out of the frame a little bit based on like when and how he's needed. But anyway, that was like one of those where I was like, I think the Devil's Snare is there because I think originally Neville went.
Oh, I think that's interesting. That is interesting. Also, in case you're wondering how the rest of the characters from that era round out, Ginny is supposed to be Lily and Luna is Snape.
Luna is Snape, but again, a much, much, much better Snape.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing. The present generation, Harry, Ron, Hermione, Neville, Luna, and Ginny are like the best versions of the characters from the past.
Exactly.
Other than like Lily and... Lily's sort of like a flawless character in the story, so there's not much...
to really change.
Yeah, not much to change about there. Ginny's just cool either way. But like, Luna's like a Snape who... Like, Snape is a character. They're both like the outcast characters, basically. And it's like they have like the friendship with the Ginny Lily character archetype going on there. But then Snape lets himself be defined by the way that like other people treat him. And even though people treat Luna the same way, like she doesn't let that define her.
Exactly. Yep. I think it's the perfect way to phrase it. So it's sort of like one of the least likely comparable characters.
Right. You know,
like Luna and Snape, they seem nothing alike, but that is sort of like the way in which they both fall into that original Marauders equation. Mm-hmm. They're waiting for Malfoy to see whether or not like he's going to actually show up. And let's see here. I'm trying to figure out how to lead myself into this. There's the Curse of the Bogies.
Curse of the Bogies.
Which I think is sort of like, I think the Curse of the Bogies is a really ominous way of saying the Bat Bogie hex.
Yeah.
Which like feels like one of the more common hexes that like largely comes to pass. Like, it feels like it's sort of in vogue during Harry's time.
Yeah.
So I
never even know what that's supposed to mean. Like, is it supposed to make like turn, like make bats come out of your nose? Is it like, are you covered in like, bats not?
It always seems like, they describe it as like little flapping things all over your skin, which almost makes me think like, I don't know, it's really kind of disgusting to think about. but it's almost like boogers affixed to your face that are then flapping.
Right.
Is sort of like my interpretation of it, which is just...
Okay. The bat bogey hex.
Yeah, just kind of horrendous.
I also just highlighted where it said, the Curse of the Bogies Quirrell told us about, and I just like made a little note, just said, teaching! Yeah. Oh my gosh!
Something
Quirrell
learned.
He did a teach.
Amazing. But from there, we pretty much see that Malfoy again has absolutely set them up.
Mm-hmm.
Filch is once again sort of like discovering them and or just simply waiting inside of the trophy room where they're supposed
You gotta love that Filch is totally okay with this sense of like entrapment happening here. Where it's like, oh, you set people up to get in trouble? Great, I'll get them in trouble.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And in no way, shape, or form is he just like intending to head it off. It's like instead of just waiting outside of the Gryffindor common room, he's waiting inside of the trophy room to discover them where he knows them to eventually be. Where it's like a real teacher or like somebody who's trying to like enforce rules here would simply head them off before they ever even had a chance to get this far.
Exactly.
You know, it's just ridiculous.
He thrives on the idea of being able to punish them.
Yes. Hilariously, I know that we've harped on it a lot, so I won't spend too much time on it, but they basically go directly from running into Filch and Mrs. Norris to running into Peeves, which I once again think is just literally no mistake. I think that they're just on opposite ends of the same coin. They are out in the middle of the castle for the same reason. One is trying to enforce rules. One is trying to cause chaos. Just again, I think like doubles down on that idea that Filch is just in fact a poltergeist, and it just keeps coming up, and I feel like it keeps fitting.
Yep.
But when they do run into Peeves, they say, "Shut up, Peeves, please. You'll get us thrown out." And so just once again, just like another nod to this idea.
Like, you were out of bed. That's it. You don't get to learn magic ever again, ever.
Right, right. Yes, yes. As if that is how it would work.
Then they find the door, which is locked, and opens to Alohomora, which like what a pointless lock. Like, there's so many other ways they can lock this door that like Alohomora won't work on it. It's like, this is the kind of like thing that makes it feel like Dumbledore wants it to be discovered. It's like,
yes.
Yeah, now
like on some, because, and that's the thing is that, you know, he, like, what am I trying to say here? The accidental stumbling into this room is just an extremely dangerous thing to simply have happen. So it's like, okay, so it's locked. That means first years can't get into it. But like, basically, like, as soon as you've learned the spell, it's like,
yeah, anyone could get in. But it's like, it's not only a matter of like not wanting someone to be able to get in because they might get hurt by Fluffy. It's like making this door itself difficult to get through should just be another layer in guarding the stone.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And that's like one of those as well, like where you can start to inch your way, and I won't do too much of it now because I want to save it for later, but the Dumbledore's big plan.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially suggests that everything to do with the recovery of the stone is effectively just an obstacle course specifically created for Harry and friends.
Yeah.
But we'll delve into that really big as we get towards the end of this book here. But so anyway, yeah, so they basically successfully escape Peeves. They eventually make it back to the, they encounter Fluffy, that is like one of those things as well where like Fluffy is just locked inside of this room.
Oh, I know.
For the whole year.
A whole year. Ron even says like, if any dog needs exercise, that one does. And I was like, no, but for real, that is a real thing. Like, come on.
I highlighted that same phrase and literally said, not a terrible point.
Yeah.
Like that is just true.
I know. Poor Fluffy up there.
Yep. But then, so they make it back into the common room by using the password pig snout. We get the totally infamous line from Hermione, who says, "I hope you're pleased with yourselves. We all could have been killed or worse, expelled."
I know. I'll highlight that one. It's such a classic line. And I noticed this too, is that on just the page before that, when they're in the room with Fluffy, it says, "Harry groped for the doorknob. Between Filch and death, he'd take Filch." So it's like Harry actually has like the same thought process, but in reverse.
Oh, that's hilarious.
He's like, yeah. Worse to be, or better to be expelled than dead. And then Hermione one page later is like, we could have been expelled. I'd rather have died.
It's almost surprising in that case. Yeah. Hermione's not like, nope, we're staying in this room. Yeah. I'm not going out there and getting expelled. Right? Like,
excuse me, take my chances with the dog.
Right. So anyway, we're starting to get like the foundation a little bit for not only the relationship between, you know, who we affectionately refer to as the Golden Trio, but also sort of this habit they have of sneaking out in the middle of the night, which I do eventually think like pairs up really nicely with the reception of the invisibility cloak, you know, where it's like, like they sort of have to struggle with being out in the middle of the night a little bit and like, endure some of the woes about the fact they're just fully exposed until they can eventually be perfectly protected by
it's the unbelievable to me that the four of them managed to successfully sneak out and not get caught without the cloak, and later on Harry almost can't go three steps with the cloak on without getting caught by Filch.
That's a good point. It does feel a little bit like maybe some of Harry's like use of the cloak in the middle of the night. It's like nobody's out in the middle of the night, like the corridors are all empty.
I know, just
simply like, you know, not that you wouldn't have to be careful, but if you were listening, or if it, you know, Filch was required to like carry a torch, you know, it's like in that particular instance, just look around each corner before you go out. Yeah,
exactly. Like, and the other thing is that, like, if this is another thing that points to Filch being a poltergeist, is that he is apparently just out in the castle every night, but he's also working in the castle all day.
Yeah, so
it's like it doesn't seem like he needs to sleep. Like, why? There's no reason. Like, I guarantee you at boarding schools, there's not people just patrolling the halls at night, making sure students are in their bed.
Yeah.
You just trust the students to stay in bed.
Right. I mean, it would seem like it would seem like such a large amount of effort for something that I think most nights would not end up being a problem.
Yeah. Well, especially there's the other thing, especially for the Gryffindor, I realize is like they get back and they're like, pigs not. And the fat lady's back and she lets them in. It's like the fat lady is like, for the Gryffindors, should just be the reason none of you ever go out. Like literally every day McGonagall must go to the Gryffindor common room at some point and she could just be like, anyone get out of bed last night?
I wrote that down actually because I was curious about the exact same thing. I was like, is it possible that the fat lady is not able to report students? Because I mean, even like when we fast forward to like a reminiscence from Molly and Arthur, we know that like one night in particular they were out past like 4:30 in the morning or something like that. And it's like it does seem like the fat lady would just be like a really, really, really good security system just to simply be like, yeah, this person was out in the middle of the night.
Like, right. Like anytime anyone, cause she can visit the other frames. Like as soon as students get out, she could just be like, well, I'm going to have to go wake up Minerva or Dumbledore or whoever.
But I wonder, maybe this is like one of those things too, where it's like, I think at the end of the day, like Dumbledore doesn't really mind a little rule breaking.
Oh, it reminds me of Ender's Game where like when he gets to the school and Ender is like, they wouldn't have made these so easy to hack if they didn't expect us to do it.
That's true.
You know, it feels like there's a little, like, I always feel like Dumbledore has this, like that sort of whimsy about him with rule breaking where he's like, of course we have rules, but like wink, wink, you know?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. Like eventually even with the Mirror of Era said, like Dumbledore clearly is like giving Harry the cloak with the knowledge that Harry's going to leave the dormitory and go exploring. And he's basically waiting for him where he expects him to ultimately, right. You know, be in a castle that you could otherwise easily get lost in. So it's like Dumbledore is pretty sure about like how certain things are going to go. The other thing too, I guess, that you could keep in mind is it's hard to know how long the Gryffindor common room has used the fat lady portrait as its mechanism for entry. But if it's been up there since the beginning and it's a millennium old, it's like it's possible that like literally she's just witnessed so many kids be out in the middle of the night that like she just doesn't think that much of it anymore.
Right,
it's
like whatever.
It's like for the past 1,000 years, kids have been sneaking out in the middle of the night.
Right, yeah.
So it's like,
I'm just gotta let the kids be kids, man.
Exactly. So,
well, speaking of which, the chapter art for this particular chapter, The Midnight Duel, features the fat lady.
Yes, it sure does. Yeah, you get an interesting look here. And it's funny because, like, they talk often about climbing through the portrait hole. And I think in particular, at one point, Ginny is frustrated that Dean is like helping her through the portrait hole.
Yeah.
And she's like, you're always doing that, Dean. Like, yeah, you know, you're always helping me through the hole. And this is like, it's funny because, and maybe it's because I was influenced partially by this particular photo just in the first book, but I never think of the portrait hole as like something you would need help to get through.
Yeah.
I always just sort of think of it as like a big painting hanging on the wall and there's just like a threshold like any other door would have. Like,
yeah. I mean, it seems like the door doesn't extend all the way to the ground. Like there is a certain amount of like stepping through it. I've always imagined this one, the one in the book makes it look like really big. Like you do have to step over it, but I think it, like in my mind, I've always imagined it like a big oval or something, which seems like it would be such a hassle in the morning if lots of students are all exiting the common room at the same time. Like, hold on, we all got to climb through.
That does. Yeah. It seems like that would be incredibly cumbersome to kind of like weasel your way through this like unusual position every time. You're right though. Maybe I have pictured an oval in my head and it's like, how big does the oval have to be in order to have a proper shaped rectangle behind it?
Yeah. I mean, it's not the portrait door. It's the portrait hole.
The portrait hole. Yeah.
I've never described a hole, you see a square hole?
A square hole. Actually, for a period of time, also, like before we really got going with Super Carlin Brothers, our mom works for the local SPCA.
Yeah.
And I was digging the graves for the pet cemetery.
Oh, what a fun job.
As like a spare, yeah, like my side hustle or whatever. Which, one, digging holes, the hardest exercise known to man, very difficult. But oddly, I do think of holes sometimes as square, because I was digging graves.
All right, well.
And they were square. But that was a total aside and mostly just an opportunity to talk about this really weird and eclectic job I once did. Anyway, so what do you think of the chapter art? You like this one?
I like this one, yeah. I think it's so funny that it shows Harry and Ron like in their pajamas and even in their like in the chapter it says like they put on their bathrobes and I was like, guys, what, you're going to what you think is a duel. Why aren't you wearing better clothes?
Yeah.
What are you doing? Why are you going to be out there dueling Malfoy in your bathrobe?
In your bathroom?
I know,
that does feel like one of those things like where I can imagine Malfoy showing up actually and being like, he's wearing bathrobes? Like,
Potter.
It feels like the type of thing Malfoy would never let Harry live down.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that so would anyway. Be it. Yeah, he's just there with the camera. Oh, gotcha.
Gotcha. Gotcha journalism at its best.
Yep.
Okay, do you have a review for us for today?
Well, I can give you a quick review from over on Apple Podcasts here. Yes, this one comes from Rachel C., who says, such a great conversation. I listened to all the available episodes, 1 through 5, and then had to get my husband involved, so we were starting from the beginning and getting caught up. We listen to the books every night to go to sleep, and the questions we have are similar to the ones that the Carlin brothers bring up. I love their conversation, and we can still have over the books. My husband wants to know if squibs can use magical objects or not, if you could help him out.
Ooh, that's interesting. So they could use like a port key?
Could they use a port key? Like, I'm like thinking like the Deluminator or something. It seems like I don't see any reason that wouldn't work, you know?
That's true.
That it seems like you just click it. Would it be like, no, you're not magic. This is just a lighter to you.
This literally just does the function you expect it to.
Yeah.
That feels like the type of thing like a magical inventor may incorporate into kind of like Newt's Commander's case, like where he has the ability to like magicify it or not, you know, on the basis of. But that's something he's manually doing, not just like if you open it, it's like, you know, to anybody else. It just
this is a
like,
good question because it's like could a squib go into the pensive? You know, something like that.
I know. Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's
could
like
anyone any... could a muggle.
Right. That's the question. Yeah. It's like I'm trying to get like a baseline for anything that we see that could potentially be unusual.
Okay. What's coming to mind is ghosts for me, where muggles can't become ghosts. Only wizards can become ghosts.
Okay.
But so could a squib become a ghost? This is a tricky one.
That is a tricky one.
Hmm.
I mean, again, I think we have a very, very, very small example to go off of, but I do think Jacob uses a port key in the Fantastic Beasts movies when they go on the bucket.
You're right. You're right.
And
so if, to that end, yes.
Yeah. So I think that would be, that's the only nearly canon explanation that we would have as to how or when or why, like anybody who's non-magical, because I largely think that when it comes down to it, a squib is sort of like a derogatory term that is otherwise just being used towards what are effectively just like witch and wizard born muggles.
Right. But there is like some, I think the problem comes when Mrs. Fig is defending Harry in court.
And it's the question of whether or not
squibs can see the Dementors. Because muggles can't see Dementors, but wizards can. But she's a squib, and she says she can, and they don't know.
Yeah, even I think Fudge in that situation is like, can they? And like this is like one of those situations where you can't tell because like Mrs. Fig seems better than we've ever really known her to be in the past. Like in terms of like... She even says, like, you know, I had to kind of make it uncomfortable for you for all those years because otherwise the Dursleys, you know, if they thought you were having a good time, they wouldn't have let you come over.
Yeah.
So you're like almost wondering, like, to what lengths was Mrs. Fig being like, man, I'm really gonna have to like find ways to make this uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Or is Mrs. Fig still just sort of like a, like, you know, your stereotypical like cat lady who, you know, lives, you know, in solitude and although, maybe.
Even to that end, like, this is like some extracurricular reading on like Pottermore, but like Mrs. Fig is not just, it's not cats, they're Neasles
that
she's
true.
Breeding. So she's still like interacting with the magical world.
That's a good point.
In some capacity.
Yeah.
Right?
And yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point. And the other one too is that like if you're a muggle, you're not supposed to be able to see the castle. And to backtrack on our own theory about Filch, who otherwise we believe to be a squib,
right?
Based on the writing,
yeah. That's not necessarily canon. But so like within the story, he's presumably just a squib who works at the school, but he can see the school because he works there.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So that must mean on some level, I feel
but then Jacob goes inside the school too.
That's also true.
Yeah.
That's also true.
Yeah. So it's like maybe once you like from afar, it would look like moldering old ruins. But like once you actually went inside, it would just look like it's supposed to.
Maybe that's like that's like one of those things where it does feel like there's a big disillusionment charm over the whole castle. But it's like a disillusionment charm is just simply so that you don't keep investigating. It's just sort of be like, well, there's no reason to go over there. Which, you know, if you know anything about actual human muggles, we would absolutely investigate ruins to the nth degree.
Yeah, right.
So it's like that. I don't think that would really dissuade most muggles, but either way. But that would suggest that like if you were to cross through the barrier, then of the disillusionment charm, then what you would see is just what's actually there.
I think muggles could use magical objects. I think the port key is a great example. Like the Porky exists and they use it. And I feel like if Jacob was holding the invisibility cloak, he could use it.
Right.
You know,
he also, if he drinks the giggle water, it does cause him to giggle, which
right.
sounds like not that magical, but I'm assuming that giggle water is a magically infused beverage.
Like beverage. Yeah.
You know, so it's like on some level, like it is doing the thing that it is supposed to be able to accomplish. Cause there's no like liquid you could drink now that would like, you would take a sip and make you laugh.
Right.
So, okay. Okay. I think Squibs.
I mean, Jacob was in Newt's case, you know,
that's true.
Yeah,
that's true. I think Squibs could interact with magical objects.
Yeah. Okay.
I think so. Yeah. I think that you couldn't channel your magic through anything, but that doesn't mean that a magical object wouldn't still do what it magically does of its own accord.
Right.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because even if you go to like Fred and George's disappearing head hats,
yeah.
like Hermione comments that the spell inside of the hat must be like particularly like skillful.
Yeah. But this is also just Arthur's whole job is just the misuse of Muggle artifacts, and it's just like Muggles getting, you know, in accidents with magically enchanted objects. So
that's
like
also
true.
I mean, yeah.
they don't know how to use them correctly, but they interact with them plenty.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
So yes,
yes.
To answer your question,
But it wasn't obvious.
Yeah,
we
got there.
Yeah, we got there in the end. So anyway, but yeah, if you guys have any reviews for us, it certainly does help the show out a lot. If you'd be happy to go and leave us a 5-star, you may also get the opportunity to hear your review read here on the podcast.
Oh, and so leave us a question. That was fun.
The questions are fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also have a spreadsheet down below, which I feel like we have not interacted with in the way that we want to at all. Not a spreadsheet, but a Google form where if you have a question about a specific chapter, especially if it's one that is upcoming, you can submit your question through there. And that is actually something we can try to incorporate into future episodes of the show.
Yeah.
So that's a great way to sort of, you know, get involved a little bit in the conversation. And maybe if there's something that Jay and I don't happen to catch inside of the chapter, which I have to say, it blows my mind how often me and you have highlighted the same.
Oh, I know, like, the things that phrases. Like stand out to us.
Yeah. But that possibly is due to the fact that you and I look at the story through the same lens so frequently. Anyway.
Yeah.
But if there's anything we haven't touched on, anything that you know is upcoming that you want to make sure that we do discuss, be sure to check out that Google form down below and submit it. We would absolutely appreciate it. But I think that's all for today.
Yeah. Otherwise, we'll see you next time through the Gryffindor.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.